Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 3:17 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is May 5th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Now, I thought I'd kick off with the Dow Gold Ratio, and I think veteran subscribers will be familiar with the argument that I was making for most of the time between 2010 and 2019. That this was a new big secular bull market for stocks, that gold would probably underperform, and that one should be long of equities. And that was based upon the long-term cycle. And we can see that there was a peak in 1929, there was another peak in 65, and another in 1999. And there was almost an identical period of time between those peaks. So we had about 36 years between the first, 35 years between, or well, I guess 34 years between the last. So let's average it out and say, well, then the next big bull market would peak in about 2034. And that was assuming that the ratio would continue to trend higher in a reasonably orderly manner, potentially even accelerate higher at some point. But that has not been the case. It was going absolutely fine until about 2018. Then it broke lower and hit a low in March of 2020, rebounded, and now it's rolling over again. So this is not consistent. It's in no way is it a consistent chart. If anything, we might just simply equate it with the kind of activity that we had in there. Between about 1935 and approximately 1946. Of course, it is also worth reminding ourselves that was the Depression and also the middle of, and I guess all the way through, the Second World War. Well, if we're thinking then about what could have happened to change the cyclicality of the market, because it is, I think, rather interesting that almost rhythmic period between the peaks of outperformance of stocks versus commodities falls very neatly into the Kondratiev wave approximation, which is approximately 40 years. So, what has happened to change it? Well, there are a couple of potential answers. And I think each one of those answers will give us some information about where we are in the world and how the world has evolved over the course of the last 100 years. So, back in 1929, the Dow Jones was the stock market index and gold was money. By the time we get around to the peak in 1965, well, the dollar had become the reserve currency of the world. And then we'd had a very significant depreciation in the purchasing power of the dollar as there was an enormous boom. There was the evolution of the stock market as in the Nifty 50 bull market. And then the country started spending, the USA started spending beyond its limits or beyond its capacity, and it started devaluing the currency against gold. Gold started to really outperform stocks after 1966. By the time we get around to the early 1970s, when inflation started to pick up, well, then maintaining the gold standard then was no longer tenable. And Nixon closed the gold window, gold leapt higher, and this ratio collapsed. But then it rebounded and then kept on going down, all the way down into the lows in the early 1980s. So that was a change, and the closing of the gold window, and then subsequently the oil embargoes, it introduced the question or the rationale around the petrol dollar. So we've had a dollar supported gold market or a dollar supported oil market for most of the last 50 years. And now the bigger question is whether if Gold is still a monetary metal. Is it as monetary as oil is, or is it more monetary than oil is? But it certainly, gold has competition as a monetary commodity after the introduction of the petrodollar system in the 1970s. So then it does behoove us to question whether looking at simply the Dow Jones as the barometer of the stock market, when there are more liquid indices and then bigger, and then of course we have the evolution of the technology sector. So that then begs us two big questions. First, is the Dow Jones the best barometer for the stock market, and is gold the best barometer for money or monetary equivalents? So then let's think about the kind of environment we had in the 1990s. So we had a huge acceleration of the stock market relative to gold in the late 1990s, which was very similar to the outperformance of the stock market in the 1920s. It's a similar kind of acceleration. Of course, this one went up much more. Then subsequently a massive decline over the ensuing decade as gold put in positive performance year after year, 10 consecutive years of positive performance for gold in an environment where stocks mostly either went down or sideways. And that then created the conditions where valuations had contracted. So we had a generational long period of P/E ratio contraction, rising dividend yields. Now, we didn't have a big move higher in yields simply because interest rates have been very low for a long time. And by historical standards, we've been in this long period of contracting rates. So that's an additional factor that the interest rate is not a part of this ratio. So that's an additional factor that we should be looking to think about. But one thing that is certain is that this long-term cycle is no longer in place. And if it is in place, then it will need to not only sustain a move up through 20, but it will then subsequently have to continue to trend higher and exceed the peak from 1999, and subsequently not peak until approximately 2033 or 2034. And that would represent a phenomenally large bull market in stocks. So we have the then, of course, there's another big question here, and I think this is very relevant at present. Is the foundation for what money is changing? Now, we've had a generational long period where gold was a monetary metal, and that lasted for generations. Then we've had one generation where oil has been the most liquid commodity market and denominated in dollars. So we've had a petrodollar system. Now, the bigger question is, are we moving into a new phase? Because the real value in the economy today is in data. And the greatest applications of data gathering, interpretation, and then autonomously in interpreting it through artificial intelligence and deep learning, those are where the big value propositions are evolving from. But I think it does beg the question, is that where the is it the services sector and the evolution of services where we're going to have greater efficiency in manufacturing, where the promise of technological innovation, where there are going to be massive improvements in material science and the introduction of deep learning, then the incredible advances that we've had in artificial intelligence, think these are rather important questions. So I think this is something that we are likely to see, that there's going to be a lot more focus on the big question of whether we are going to see a big change in how the world views the monetary equivalent, and at what point is there going to be a financial model developed that will attribute a monetary value to data and data interpretation? And we have definitely seen a lot of that over the course of the last decade. So we had the introduction of Bitcoin and then a massive swell of interest in various crypto ledgers. Now, I'm very much of the view that Bitcoin is a, and I've said it on multiple occasions, that it's a liquidity barometer. But there is no doubt that the price has gone up a lot since it was introduced, and it's still hovering here at around 29,000. Now, a good part of the reason for that is because the sheer volume of cash that has been printed in the last decade has been almost mind-boggling. So the price of Bitcoin has appreciated in line with that. There is also the clear trend that there's a 4-year cycle in terms of the performance of Bitcoin. And you can see that there were only 3 years between the initial peak in 2011 and the beginning of 2014. But after 2014, we had almost exactly 4 years between the peaks. And then at the beginning of 2017, we go all the way out to the beginning of 2021, and we get another major peak. That 4-year cycle is very much in tune with the halvening cycle, and the next halvening will be in April of 2024. So, less than a year from now, the reward for minting a new Bitcoin will halve, and that will further enhance the limited supply argument. So it's not simply that it is appreciating relative to money supply, but also appreciating because of that limited supply argument. But it does then also beg the question whether it is the value of the network is where the monetary value is over the long term. And I think that's what going to be one of the most important questions that we address as a society over the course of the next maybe 30 or 40 years. That the bulk of economic activity used to be within the agriculture sector. Now, agriculture is still totally essential to our well-being and our survival, but it is not the dominant force in the economy. Then industrialization was the dominant force in the economy and also totally, I think, essential to our survival as a species. Without industrialization, there is absolutely no way that the global economy could support a population of 7 to 8, or maybe even 9 or 10 billion people over the course of the next 50 years. And now we've been in the computer age and the evolution of the semiconductor, and that's been also, it's a highly cyclical sector. I think that's particularly worth mentioning right now. Now, if we look at the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index on a log scale, well, then hopefully we can get a bit more back data here. So we can very clearly see that we had a phenomenally large bull market in the 1990s, where the index from its genesis went up 10 times and then subsequently did nothing for the next 16 years and then has now broken higher. Semiconductors tend to be highly cyclical, and they are generally highly capital intensive and then low margin businesses. So that is one of the reasons why a company like Nvidia, which has a price to sales ratio in the high 20s, has generally sustained those high multiples. So we can see that back there in 2000, the price to sales ratio got up towards 10, got all the way down to around 1 or 2, and then didn't really break higher until we got all the way out to 2016. Now the price to sales ratio is almost back to where it was at the peak, and there is a great deal of enthusiasm around the build out of data centers that have a just a clear focus on artificial intelligence. The pace of advance in artificial intelligence has been accelerating, but this is not a new story. Now, I spent 2 days this week at the MIT conference on artificial intelligence in well, it was I spent most of it online, but the what I thought was especially interesting, it was something that I've really been paying attention to, is the story has not changed. So we've had certainly a big innovation in large language models, and the ability of ChatGPT to write coherent answers to sometimes complicated questions, and the big jump in performance from ChatGPT 3 to ChatGPT 4 has been really quite impressive. And it went from, for example, failing the bar exam to passing the bar exam, and that happened in the space of about 3 months. So what basically the OpenAI in conjunction with Microsoft is doing is moving fast and breaking things. And I think this is important. So Microsoft has taken the attitude that if they simply move fast, that they can iterate quickly and that they'll be able to provide services that they can charge for. And the market is rewarding them for adopting that kind of strategy. So Microsoft has rebounded from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. It has broken a year-long sequence of lower rally highs, and it continues to appreciate. And then it's also eating the lunch of some of these smaller companies. And I think when we look at, and this was something that really did strike me this week, was the CEO of C3.ai. He's an incredibly engaging speaker, and he has wonderful anecdotes about sitting in on meetings with very powerful people and very senior politicians all over the world. And then is quite proud of saying that they turn away business and they won't deal with China. And they are very cognizant of the ethical implications of what they're doing. So there are plenty of government contracts they have turned down. So, the share is pretty close to its lows, and that's the kind of performance you can expect from a high growth company that refuses to grow quickly. So, Microsoft's strategy from a business perspective, from a market's perspective, is the right one because they're likely to make money from it. And the kinds of companies that have lots of expertise but want to take a slower pace, well, they're going to get left behind. That is just the simple reality. And I think there is the additional point that Microsoft is taking this and running with it, because one of the things that Jeffrey Hansen said in his talk was that Google had developed many of these capabilities in 2017, but were decided to go slow. Decided not to release them to the public and to do further work on trying to figure out how to monetize it without causing undue harm. And what OpenAI and Microsoft have demonstrated is that those innovations are replicable. So Microsoft has made the decision that if they don't go for it, someone else will. And quite likely that the people that will have a no holds barred attitude towards artificial intelligence creation for their own purposes will be China and other countries. So I think these are very important considerations that when there is an emerging, exciting technology, then the people who follow it first, the ones that really aggressively pursue it, they're most likely to gain market share. And I do suspect that in the AI, market share is going to be a really important consideration. The algorithms that are being created now and the ability of these systems to learn. And we have artificial intelligence now that can write its own computer code. Now, from the perspective of an organic organism, the ability to replicate is one of the most essential. Now, one of the limitations of organic replication is that we're pretty good at replication, but then we have to teach our offspring and bring them to maturity. Well, it takes a long time to train an AI, and this trend of artificial intelligence has been in place now for years, and there was an entire army of people employed by Amazon and Google, and their job was labeling. So in order to train these models, they had to go off and find lots of images and train them by labeling every one of those images. And now that that work has been done, then what's now possible is that those large models, having learned how to do it once, they can now identify without labeling in approximately 50% of cases. So that's a really significant improvement. So then we can think about what's next. And what I found especially interesting at this conference was the juxtaposition of Jeff Hansen, the father of artificial intelligence, saying that he's 75 years old, he's retiring or leaving Google, and he wants to feel free to talk about the risks from artificial intelligence. And he was followed immediately afterwards by this very engaging MIT professor who has developed a what they're calling a liquid algorithm. And what that's basically doing is using fewer data points to come up with the most relevant solution. And she gave the example of an early version of an autonomous driving system where a lot of the data that the model was concentrating on was on the periphery of the road. Whereas her model, using far fewer nodes and therefore much less computing power, and therefore needs less computing power and less power overall. And she was also very keen to talk about how that would improve efficiency and create fewer carbon emissions. But the example they gave was particularly creepy. That they were able to train a drone to fly around a forested area and to identify something that was relevant within that picture without telling it what that was, and it was a red sack. Then they were able to do that in multiple different weather conditions, and the AI met that challenge no problem. Then they put that backpack on a student, and the drone immediately picked it up and followed him around. Now, when you twin that with artificial intelligence, when you, excuse me, when you twin that artificial intelligence with facial recognition software, well, then the potential for surveillance becomes really incredibly high. And the weaponization of these kinds of technologies, whether that is going to be in terms of population control or outright aggressive types of attitudes, those are something that I think is largely inevitable at this stage. But I think we should be thinking about what the monetary equivalents are. If you really move the needle in terms of productivity and artificial intelligence, then eventually evolves to a point where we will have autonomous vehicles, where we will have a basically butler service, and a lot of the mundane service or the mundane tasks that people are have to do now will be outsourced to an AI. I think these are significant because it means that there will be a massive change in the workforce. So, if we then think about another way of assessing what an economy is worth, well, we could think about it in terms of hours worked and hourly pay. So instead of productivity, in terms of products produced, we could think about what's the how many people do we have working, how much are they getting paid relative to the value created by data. And then the ratio of those would give us an idea about the relative importance of data to the productive capacity of the total market. And I think that that is something that will be a factor in how the economy of the future is thought about. Now, let's not get bogged down in philosophical thoughts about what's likely in the future, and think instead then about the performance that we're seeing in some of these markets. So Microsoft has got the bit in between its teeth, and it's running with artificial intelligence. And Microsoft's business model has been to really try to make up for a lot of the mistakes they made in the past by missing out on some of the big bull markets they helped to create. Amazon pioneered the web services business, but and this has been a really significant decline, and the share is steadying right now, but it hasn't quite yet broken up through that 200-day moving average yet. And the growth in the e-commerce system, I think, is has gone about as far as it's going to. I think one of the most overused statistics, which is not reflective of the size of the market, is that the e-commerce sector has only taken over X percentage of the retail market. But within the retail market is also loans and financing for buying cars. Now, I don't think anyone's going to start buying cars on Amazon. Lots of companies have tried it, CarMax being one of those that trying to sell cars from the online, but you're not going to have your car delivered by Amazon, and you're not going to buy your house on Amazon. That's another retail transaction. So I think the size of the potential e-commerce market is overstated, and this has been a significant deterioration. Now, the big question then is, Where is it going to stabilize? And are we going to move into a lengthier period of ranging? Because this is an aggressive multiple. It's still trading at an estimated PE of 70. And I think that we do have to just think about this in a logical perspective. Now, let's look at the performance of the Nasdaq relative to gold. And what I find rather interesting here is that if we think about the Nasdaq as being the measure of the performance of the market, well, then relative to gold, it's not quite as consistent on the upside as it used to be, but we're at a really critical juncture. And the Nasdaq gold ratio is hovering here around the six level. And now the question, of course, is whether it's going to hold this support, because this is also the region of the 5-year moving average. And if gold breaks higher from here without a commensurate move in the Nasdaq, then it's going to break down through six, and that will suggest that a lot of the good news in the technology sector has probably already been priced in. Now, let's then also look at oil relative to our Dow relative to oil. And then we still have the sequence of higher reaction or the higher highs. And we have more back history. So there was a major peak in 1905, then another in 1929, so that's 24 years, then another in 1966. Well, and I think really the high was in 68, so that's a much longer interval. And then a peak in 99 and a peak in 2020, so 21 years. And then subsequently a meaningful decline. Now, it's the sequence of higher reaction or higher, excuse me, higher highs is the primary consistency characteristic because we don't really have the higher lows. They're all over the place. And oil has, or the Dow relative to oil has bounced over the course of the last 8 or 9 months. Now, if we think about the Nasdaq relative to oil, then we also have the higher high and a very similar performance of stocks relative to oil more recently. But then it does bring us back to this question about debt. And there has been this aggressive argument about the efficacy of modern monetary theory over the last 5 or 6 years, and the pandemic splurge was a major experiment in the broader macroeconomic environment. So the assumption was that you could simply print as much money as was required, and there wouldn't be any negative consequences unless inflation took off. And of course, then inflation did take off. So I think we now know without any kind of argument, and it's pretty obvious, but this, regardless of whether something is obvious or not, a lot of people will be willing to push the needle when they've lots of evidence from their personal experience that inflation hasn't picked up. But if you give people money for doing nothing and tell them they don't have to work, and then subsequently give them more money, then they will spend and you will get an inflationary uptick. And that inflationary uptick broke the long uptrend in the total return of treasuries. So treasuries did spectacularly well from the early 1980s until approximately 2020. And since then, it has broken the uptrend. Now, the performance has rebounded over the last 6 or 7 months, and it is quite likely to come up into the region of that 1,000-day moving average. But this is a major trend inconsistency. When a trend that has been nothing but consistent for 40 years changes, we do need to pay attention. And it does suggest that this inflationary bias is something that is material. So that is part of the reason why gold is now appreciating, because It's going up in both relative and nominal terms. And the price of gold is hovering here around the 2000 level. And it is quite orderly in the region of the upper side of this range. Now, it did not hold the move to the upside this week. And we can see that at the peak in January of, or I guess February of 2022, there was a long tail on the candle. But gold did bounce from the $2,000 level this week, so, or in here today, I should say. Could we have some consolidation here, or additional consolidation? I think that is possible. The most benign scenario would be if the $2,000 level holds, and I think that might be too much to hope for. But if it breaks higher, and I suspect that it will break higher, then we're going to move into a really different environment, because if gold breaks higher relative to the Nasdaq, that will not only have then broken its lengthy period of underperformance relative to industrials like the Dow Jones, but it will also have broken its period of underperformance relative to the technology sector. And I think that would be a very material change. And then, of course, it does beg the question, will the other commodities follow suit? Or is this more about the change in how money is appreciated? Or is it more about a very significant increase in the tax on consumption represented by a big jump in the price of commodities? That's also a significant possibility. The one thing that I'm not a full-throated commodity a new secular bull market advocate just yet is because I think bull markets require a rationale that is optimistic. And the industrialization of China was incredibly optimistic. And the end of the Cold War, the introduction of China into the global economy, lifting hundreds of millions of people and out of poverty into the middle classes, that's incredibly optimistic. It's something that everybody can get behind. And that was powered by coal-fired power stations. So, pollution in China was off the charts when I first went there in 2005. You couldn't see more than about 10 meters in front of you, and even that was difficult. And I remember going to see the Forbidden City, and you could see absolutely nothing. So, but that didn't matter. Because even though you had this incredible pollution, it still represented an incredible jump in living standards for the entire population. And it fueled a massive commodity bull market. Now, what we're being told today is if we don't do something, the consequences will be dire. And the finger wagging warnings that we're receiving now, well, it might be rational, but it's not inspiring. And it's, it really is more of a cautionary tale that if you don't do something, something bad will happen. Well, that's akin to selling insurance, and nobody likes paying for insurance. You generally pay for insurance because you feel like you have to. And usually people don't buy, for example, a burglar alarm for their house until after they've been burgled. And I think that alone is something that's a mitigating factor in terms of the rollout of the renewable energy and electrification. I'm fully on board with the fact that these are observable trends, but I don't think that they're going to be as quick as anyone is thinking, because it just takes time and money to rebuild an entire electricity infrastructure. And we're going to be in the long period where there's going to be competition for resources. And natural gas prices are close to their record lows, and particularly in the USA. So the natural gas price continues to hover here around the $2 level. And this has been a really profound contraction. The Northern Territory in Australia has begun to start really thinking about how they're going to start producing from their own gas fields, which are expected to be larger than those in Texas. So this is a profoundly large resource. And that's really good news. We need low energy prices to fuel an economic expansion. This backward thinking that you need high commodity prices to encourage substitution and to make alternatives viable, then that is an incredibly expensive way of trying to generate economic growth. Much better to have cheap energy to really enhance the productive capacity of people and to lift people out of poverty and into the middle classes. And there are going to be an extra 2 billion people born and in the global economy over the next 30 years. And a lot of those people are going to be in Africa. And they can't wait. They need cheap energy, and they need to be provided with the tools necessary to enhance their condition. Because without it, there's going to be significant social unrest. And there are massive migration patterns already evolving. And the migration of people from Africa into Europe and from Latin America into North America, or I guess from South America into North America, isn't something that's going to change. And the only possible way to avoid that would be to create better economic opportunities in their own countries. And that is certainly not something that is easy. But what it is resulting in is a lot of political agitation, and certainly big movements in countries like Chile and Argentina, and indeed in Mexico, to ensure that the resources that are extracted in those countries are processed there. And Mexico has nationalized its lithium, and they want to build the battery factories in Mexico. So that's certainly a big change. But what it is benign in terms of ensuring that there is more varied economic activity in the areas where these resources are actually manufactured. But then, of course, you have to deal with the cost of shipping the finished products to their end markets as well. Then we also have the big changes that are underway in the shipping sector. The Baltic Dry Index surged higher to a peak in 2021, collapsed to test its lows in the early part of this year, and has subsequently rebounded. We're seeing a big change in the shipping sector because of the emissions rules that have been imposed. And what that has basically resulted in is that the scrubbers that were suggested for these ships cost more than the ships themselves, so that wasn't viable. And the other way to reduce emissions is to go slower. So that's what they're doing. But of course, that means you need more ships to do the same amount of work. And that is supporting the Baltic Dry Index price, where it is now steadying from the region of the 200-day moving average. But again, that is a more expensive way of doing the same thing. So that the evolution of electrification, the trend towards penalizing economic activity because of a carbon production or a new carbon metric. These are, I think, going to further enhance the inflationary trend. And that suggests that inflation's not going to collapse, or if it does collapse in a recession, that it will rebound quickly. And it does raise the question then, are we going to have a recession where inflation is vanquished and we move back into a very benign economic environment? Or are we going to have an environment where inflation comes back down, but not sufficiently to kill it off, and then goes back up again? And putting roadblocks in our way and adding additional layers of regulation and then creating new taxes like carbon emissions. That's only going to raise the cost of doing business and makes it less efficient. That means you can do less with more. And that's not good news for global economic activity. So we're certainly in a rather tense environment where the reliance on technological solutions, it was a nice to have in cycles past, and now it is totally essential. Then you do have some of the solution providers, and Eli Lilly is accelerating higher right now. And that was a very consistent trend after it broke out of the long-term base formation in 2019. And then it accelerated higher with the introduction of its obesity drug, or I guess its diabetes drug, that is now also a ready solution for obesity. Now that's a productivity enhancer. So that's a really significant technological innovation, that you have a drug that addresses a major chronic condition in diabetes, but then also addresses a related but separate condition like obesity, which detracts from individual productivity. So that's a really significant evolution. And now we also have evolving solutions for Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's, of course, most often affects elderly people, but it's an incredibly expensive disease to treat. So any kind of solution for Alzheimer's is very good news for the cost of elder care, which is a material change or a material question for government bonds. So the 10-year yield in the US is continuing to hold here in the region of the 200-day moving average. And we're still in this Goldilocks scenario where interest rates have gone up a lot, and the Fed funds rate has gone up 500 basis points, and the ECB is catching up, although they don't really want to fully catch up. And the 10-year minus the 3-month yield curve spread is around 176 basis points to the negative, and coming into around where it was in the early 1980s. So we're definitely looking at rather tight conditions. And I think this is something that we just can't forget. The pace of the hiking cycle has been particularly quick. So we've seen that this was a good graphic this week. You can see that this is by far the fastest hiking cycle we've had. So that's, I think, something that we really should pay attention to. And it's not like this is going to simply be I guess this isn't something that we can just ignore. That we have an inverted yield curve. We have money supply growth that is negative. And We have banks that are going bust at a quickening pace. Now, the banking sector in the USA rebounded off its lows yesterday, and it followed through on the upside in here today. And we have a very deep short-term oversold condition. So it certainly wouldn't be beyond the bounds of possibility that we get some pause and consolidation. But what these banks need more than anything is for the economy to avoid a recession, for credit conditions to ease, and for government bond yields to come back down so that they can sell some of their really loss-making, longer-dated investments. And that's something that's not likely in the very short term. So we've definitely seen a rebound in markets. And after four consecutive days on the downside, the S&P 500 rebounded. And it's been hovering here below the 4,200 level for a year now. So this is a good-sized upward dynamic. And it's the second one in the space of a week. So we might see some additional upside here. But I don't believe that the services sector doing well is always going to be able to avoid the reality that credit conditions are tightening. So when I think about a company like Nvidia, where a lot of their sales are coming from China, and there is an outstanding risk of geopolitical tensions knocking out their ability to sell their products in China. Well, there is obviously the potential that the valuation will not be realizable. And we've had a good uptick in demand for consumer products over the course of the last quarter. And a lot of that was because of China's consumers coming back into the market. And Apple popped on the upside in here today following its earnings. And the largest company in the world coming through with strong earnings is certainly a confidence booster. And it's now right in the region of the most recent lower rally high. So not only does it have to pop on the upside, it needs to follow through on the upside next week. If the Federal Reserve, looking at the stronger payrolls data here, is more encouraged to continue to raise rates, then that is going to further tighten credit conditions. It's going to put more pressure on the banking sector. And banks are one of the major money creators. The credit engine is one of the primary drivers of the economy. And with the pressure the banking sector is under, then higher interest rates for longer are going to be a material challenge. So these are, I think, when we think about where the future is, these evolutions we're seeing in the technology sector are incredibly inspiring. There's obviously the potential that the ex-US portion of the market has potential to outperform. So I do apologize. Last week I was having had mental diarrhea and I could not remember the ticker I'd created for this ratio. But what I find most especially interesting is that this trend has been broken, and we had this incredibly lengthy period where US markets outperformed, or I guess ex-US markets underperformed the USA for the better part of 15 years, and the trend is now broken. And we had a similar period of clear outperformance, mostly really beginning in 1999, but taking off in 2002. And that was a big change. And this coincided with the commodity bull market and the evolution of China as a major global economy. So there is certainly the potential that the USA is going to over-tighten, that there will be issues. And what I found most especially interesting today is that the dollar was weaker. even though the prospect of higher interest rates in the USA looks more likely, even though bond yields were up a little rather than down, and there's the possibility that you'll have a wider interest rate differential in favor of the USA, the dollar was weaker because I think investors are beginning to look at the inevitability that a recession is coming, that there will be a meaningful change in the outlook for the dollar because there will have to be a big stimulus and cutting interest rates to deal with that recession. And there are huge unfunded liabilities and a political environment where they just cannot seem to agree on how to curtail spending. And that means that they're likely to devalue the dollar in service to political ambitions. And that's a more acute risk in the USA right now than it is elsewhere. If the dollar trends lower, commodity prices will appreciate, most particularly gold as a monetary metal. We'll certainly see more interest coming through in the cryptocurrency sector because of the halving in April of next year. Generally speaking, the big moves higher in Bitcoin have coincided with massive monetary accommodation. So that is certainly a possibility. And then we can look at that ratio of the ex-US versus the US markets, and it has clearly broken its trend. And then I haven't really been talking about my little index of Mexico, India, Indonesia, Nigeria, but this ratio has popped on the upside. And excuse me, it's not a ratio, but this amalgamation of these four markets on an equal weighted basis is popping on the upside here and coming up to the upper side of this range that's been forming since 2007. And I think that these will be among the markets that benefit most from reshoring, rising geopolitical tensions, and the rise of the global consumer. And I think with that, I will leave you for the week, and I wish all the best to all of you.